What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station tomorrow on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.
97.1 FM Talk Podcast.
This hour of the Mark Reardon Show is sponsored by Gamma Tree Experts. Your trees deserve the best care. Call Gamma Tree Experts. This is the Mark Reardon Show on 97.1 FM Talk.
Well, right now we're not getting a whole lot of what happened at this meeting with Zelensky and all of the Western European leaders. It wrapped about, I think, a half an hour ago when we first started getting the reporting, and there's not a lot coming on right now. So we'll see if there's any kind of news conference or anything like that. We'll certainly take you to that as soon as possible. John Seiler is going to join us at the bottom of the hour. John has always been a great guest here the past few years at exposing some of the DEI nonsense that goes on out there. He's the director of higher education policy and a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. He has written a very interesting piece about the Justice Department cracking down on universities. And he always brings the goods. He brings the receipts, which I always love. So he's coming up at the bottom of the hour. We have an audio cut of the day as well. Jen Say is back with us this afternoon, the founder and CEO of XXXY Athletics, a U.S. champion gymnast. We've talked about her Emmy Award-winning documentary film Athlete A on Netflix. She's got a new movie that she took part in here called Generation COVID, and I believe Andrew James, the co-director of the film, is also with us. Jen, are you there? This is unusual to have two guests on at the same time. I'm going to make sure the technology is working. Testing, one, two, three. Are you there, Jen Say?
I am here.
How are you? And then
Thank you.
I think we have Andrew. Andrew, are you there as well?
I'm here. Thank you, Mark.
Well, thank you for coming on with me. I think this is an important topic. Now, first of all, just in case I don't know the latest, is this a film that people can access and watch right now, or is it coming out?
They cannot. Not yet.
Not
we
yet.
Did release it. No, not yet. We released a trailer maybe 2 weeks ago that we put on X. That's gotten a really great response, which is probably why you reached out. But the film is not available yet. And in fact, we're still looking for distribution.
Yeah, that was going to be one of my questions, because, you know, with a topic like this that should get a lot of distribution and a lot of, you know, attention, I wonder how much the legacy media will give you any kind of love, especially you, Jen, just because they know where you are on the women's rights issue, which shouldn't be controversial. But I do wonder how much, attention you might get. But these things, and Andrew, you can weigh in here as well, sometimes they take on a bit of an organic nature, and if we get the word out enough about this film, people are going to want to see it, right?
For sure. And the response has shown that there's a huge audience for the film. But of course, yeah, the legacy media, who knows how they're going to respond. We hope that someone will want to put this out, but if not, that's okay, because we've got other things working. We've got other things we're figuring out, and the film will be released no matter what.
Yeah, because you can go a theatrical route for maybe a short run, or you can just go right to streaming, depending on where you get the distribution. And streaming seems to be where it's at, and that might be the best choice for a movie like this, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I think we're planning on, you know, or hoping for a large streamer being willing to take us on. Athlete A, the film that I produced and that came out in 2020, that was on Netflix. Now it was COVID, so it was never going to be in the theaters. It was supposed to be. But that can guarantee a really large audience. I mean, for me and Andrew, the goal is that we're not just preaching to the choir here, but that we're reaching a really large audience, and that people have the opportunity to sort of go back in time, re-experience what we all experienced, and maybe see it through a different lens and perhaps reevaluate the stance they had taken back then. I mean, we made it for a broad audience. That's sort of the point. I think you're right. My brand doesn't help us necessarily. I got myself good and canceled not once, not twice, but three times. But I think the quality of the film speaks for itself. I mean, it's so beautifully done. Andrew's done an incredible job. He was not just directing it with me, but the cinematographer, and he's the editor. And it's just it's of such high quality. And the fact is, we haven't heard directly from the children. We haven't heard from them, and I think people should hear it, and they deserve to be heard.
You know, back in the spring when the Jake Tapper book was getting all that attention on Biden, David Zweig put a book out called An Abundance of Caution. I've gotten to know David a little bit. And one of the things that I've said repeatedly on this show is that that book, David Zweig's book, and I don't know if you guys play into that at all or if you've spoken with David, is more important than any book about Biden because it really does dig in deep on the stupid crap that we allowed to have happen 5 years ago and beyond, and especially what happened to these kids. And that's what I'm assuming that this documentary focuses in on, because I still talk to teachers. My daughter entered fifth grade today, but teachers will tell you that, you know, they've seen this in person. These my son's a teacher. There are these groups of kids, especially some of the younger kids, that just still have not caught up. And there's almost like a reaction in, you know, in the legacy media, like none of this stuff ever happened and that we shouldn't be ashamed of it and that we shouldn't try to correct it if it happens in the future. So, Andrew, I'll start with you on that. Why was this movie so important to make? And I don't know if you spoke with David or there's crossover themes there, but I'm curious about that.
Yeah, David plays a very large role in the film. He's great. He's one of our major voices. And what he did for his book definitely comes across in the film as well. We explore some of those topics with him. And we made the film because we don't want it to happen again. And I think there is a concern that it could happen again or something similar could happen again. And I think it's important that a lot of us look back and have this conversation as a country so that we can sort of ask the right questions next time.
Jen, is that your motivation as well? I know you're passionate about this. We've talked about it before.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And, you know, David, as Andrew mentioned, is fantastic in the film. He's a key voice. His voice is also very important, as he was one of the only journalists who was writing about the topic in real time. And so what he experienced in trying to get stories placed, et cetera, the censorship that was happening, you know, he also conveys that quite clearly in the film. But yeah, absolutely. If we don't assess what happened, we are destined to make the same mistakes again. And the vast majority of people want to memory hole it because almost everyone was complicit, at least at the very beginning.
How did you address the issue of, you know, I don't want to say teachers, because I think a lot of teachers were on the right side of this, but the teachers' union and the leadership, which were holding up signs, you know, in the summer of 2020, you're just going to kill our teachers, right? That was one of the allegations that was made by the union, that if these kids, and I advocated, I remember very specifically 5 years ago when my daughter was going into kindergarten, to say, look, these younger kids in particular need to be back in the class. But there was a refusal on the part of public health officials, on the part of a lot of elected officials, to separate what was happening with younger people compared to people certainly over the age of 70 and 75, because it's not even close to the way. And, I think we can all admit that this was a very serious virus and we didn't know much about it. But we got to know some things about it pretty early on and didn't adjust the things that we were doing in society to keep people locked down.
Yeah, I think the teachers unions played a huge role in advocating for schools to stay closed. And we actually know that's a fact. And David talks about that in his book and he talks about it in the film. So teachers unions are explored in the film. And we do talk about their role in sort of parroting the sound bites that were coming from the media. And along the same lines, the media plays a large role in the film. They're sort of a villain in the film. You see how they're driving the narrative. And I think our very much to blame for impacting people's views on what should happen.
Oh, I think so, too. Yeah. Jen, I know you agree with that, right?
Yeah, I hold special sort of disdain for the media's role in it. I mean, the media is supposed to be the fourth estate. They never interrogated the issues. They did not hold power to account. They repeated government-issued talking points and Big Pharma-issued talking points as if that was journalism. You know, a case could be made, and we do cover the teachers' union's role, and it's not just that they were very resistant to opening the schools. They actually influenced the school opening guidelines. They got them changed from what the CDC. Randy Weingarten met with Jill Biden, so that's all covered in the film. One could argue the teachers' unions represent the teachers, and they were just, you know, doing what they thought was best for the teachers. But public health is also, I would argue, a bit villainous in the film, Andrew. I don't know.
Yeah.
If you agree. I think you agree with that.
But
public health and the media, and then, you know, the governors in the large blue states, the public schools in blue states were closed for 18 months. People like to say it was only a few months. It was 18 months, and they were onerously restricted for about another year and a half after that. So half of America's public school children experienced disrupted schooling for 3 years.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And look, I've always said that we got off pretty easy here. Even though my daughter started with, you know, me supervising her Zoom calls in kindergarten, by the end of September, I think that she was finally in school. I mean, they had a mask up and all that nonsense. But we got very lucky around here compared to Blue States, Illinois, just, you know, across the river. And that was certainly a good thing. However, Do you speak with, Andrew, I'm very curious, do you speak with parents that might have been all in on the mask up stuff and some of the other nonsense that have regrets now, that kind of take a look back? I mean, we were keeping people from the beaches in Florida, and well, certainly in Los Angeles, not Florida. There were people that were pissed off if you would run in Central Park, run, jog, ride a bike, and you didn't have a mask on. I mean, some of this stuff is just comical when you look back at it.
Absolutely. It's completely comical. And I think that's why a lot of people want to forget about it. I think probably feel a little embarrassed for what they did. You know, we did talk to some parents who at first were more concerned about COVID, but they quickly realized that the impacts on their children not being in school were far more dangerous than the risks from getting COVID.
Yeah, those were the, you know, as I remember it, the way it was unfurling was very interesting, especially someone like me who talks about issues on a regular basis. And female engagement, the mama bears, that was at an all-time high. I don't know if we'll ever see anything like it, because there were a lot of, and this kind of crossed over, I don't know how much you do in the movie, it crossed over into some of the sports issues, because it was one thing that, you know, keeping kids out of school, but then you were keeping them from being active, and you were making kids as young as my daughter's age, you know, 6 or 7 years old, wear masks when they were playing basketball and volleyball and things like that. It was lunacy.
Yeah, we do touch on that. And in fact, so we feature about 6 or 7 young people in the film, teenagers mostly, because they were able to kind of express what they had gone through. And two of them were high school athletes and very much hoping for a scholarship to college, counting on it. In fact, both come from sort of lower income background, and they were counting on football scholarships, and they had to watch their peers in private schools compete into 2021 and even some in 2020 and, you know, play and get recruited for college while they were not permitted to do so. And most of the families in the film actually come from more of a left-leaning background. There's a reason for that, because we focused on states where schools were closed the longest. So those are blue states. And most of these parents, to answer your earlier question to Andrew, did start out kind of on board with everything. And exactly as Andrew said, they saw the harms very quickly. And so they spoke out and faced a ton of pushback and censorship in their communities.
So the film is called Generation COVID. You're still looking for some distribution. The trailer is out there right now. What's a best case scenario, do you think, to get us all to see this film sooner than later?
You're going to see it in the next few months, you're going to see it in the next few months. Andrew and I are very committed to that.
If I can help in any way, I just think this is such an important topic. And by the way, here's just a side note. I don't know if you saw this, Jen or Andrew. So last week I had a reporter on that sometimes contributes to the show, Jessica Kotescu, and she writes for the Free Beacon. And she took it upon herself to go to the Democrats Socialists of America conference in Chicago last weekend, right? And you had to have a ticket. You had to have party membership. This is my favorite line. Attendees were also required to submit proof of a negative COVID test prior. That was last week. That wasn't in 2023 or 2022. It was last week in Chicago. There you go.
Yeah, it's become sort of a cultural thing. It's sort of, that's really disappointing. And there's a lot of talk on the left about how, you know, this has all been politicized. And you're like, yeah, you guys politicized it. And like, you're still clinging to it all these years later.
Do you speak with any of the blue state governors or mayors that put some of this stuff into play or not?
We don't speak with them in the film, but they are very present. There is plenty of footage available, and we let them sort of hang themselves, I guess.
I can't wait to see it. Thank you guys for coming on here. Jen, you know I'm such a big fan. You know, it's funny. We had this situation at our MLS game a couple of weeks ago where there was a guy that had a MAGA hat on, and he got escorted from the building. He was not allowed to have, this is an MLS rule, something that was political. And my wife went to the next weekend's game, and she was proudly wearing her XXXY hat. And I was wondering if that hat might even get her into trouble. But they kind of cooled off on the policy, Jen. But it did kind of come to mind. Because I thought, well, this will be interesting because it's a brand, but somebody could probably make the ridiculous claim that that's a political statement, right?
Certainly. They could make any ridiculous yes,
and they have.
Could make any ridiculous claim, yeah, that they want. Well, thanks to your wife for wearing it, and thank you so much for having it, us. And if any of your viewers want to demand that a mainstream streamer take us on, we would be more than happy to hear it.
Is it generationcovidfilm.com if you want to see the trailer?
Yes, or either of our X accounts have it up. But yeah, that's the film's website, and you can look to the film's website for updates as to, you know, when we'll release it.
Well, keep me posted. I'm all over it, so I appreciate it. You know, I'm a fan. Thank you, Jen. Thank you, Andrew. Good luck.
Thank you, Mark.
Okay.
We appreciate it.
Yeah, take care. You know, and I hope it's not, here's the one thing that I wish, who was I talking to the other day? Somebody who convinced a friend of theirs to watch The Fall of Minneapolis that Liz Collin did and helped produce and direct in Minneapolis in the aftermath of the George Floyd situation. And all you, and this is what the challenge that I've had, and they never really got good distribution on that. You can watch it online. All you would have to do is watch the first 10 minutes of that documentary, and you would say to yourself, I can't even believe what I'm seeing right now. Why didn't the legacy media show me all this at the time? That's why what Jen said about the media is so important, because a lot of these things, if the media was doing its job, would not have happened. And I always point to this situation in the summer of 2021. Here I was, and I was very interested in getting, you know, all of us back to normalcy. I did my show for an entire year in the basement of my home. And then I got back when I switched over to 97.1. I was on KMOX at the time. So 2021, it would have been the spring of 21. June comes around, they're rolling out the vaccines. I am asked if I would like to participate in a campaign. I'm now going to be paid to do a campaign to promote the vaccine in the summer of 2021. Because as an idiot, and I said this, and I remember beating up on a listener who has every right in the world to hate my guts, because somebody said on a call-in show that I was doing here, I think on 97.1, oh, you just don't get it. You don't understand what's really happening. The people are in the hospital that have this. They've had the vaccine. There were people making the claim, and I'm pretty sure I even said this, that this was a vaccine. I'm sorry, it was a virus of the unvaccinated, right? Well, that was not the case. So here I start doing some messaging in June of 2021 for the vaccine with the Missouri Department of Health, and I'm promoting it. I think it's the right thing to do. As we get into the latter part of July, the whole narrative on that thing has changed. And I noticed that it had changed, and I was not comfortable with some of the things that I was being asked to say on the air to promote for people to get the vaccine. And I went to the agency that was working with the Department of Health. I actually tried to go through my salesperson here at 97.1, who's no longer here, and I was met with some resistance. So I did an end run. And I said, I went right to the agency. I said, guys, these talking points need to be updated. My reputation is on the line. The things that I'm telling the audience right now are simply not true. You remember the claim that if you got the vaccine, you couldn't, you know, transmit it to somebody else. Well, all of that was not true. There were so many things that weren't true. And in the end, I was, this is a former employee of Odyssey, but it became a big deal. And somehow, some way, I was the bad guy in all of that, even though I was trying to make sure that the messaging about the vaccine was accurate. There was no willingness at that point on the part of a particular ad agency, a sales rep here at this station, and the state of Missouri and the CDC to adjust any messaging, because I don't think they knew what they were getting into at the time. And that was embarrassing. It's embarrassing for me that I had to take part in that episode, but I tried to correct it. But I was stunned by the unwillingness to correct the narrative, even though it was so clear that it was inaccurate.
What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station tomorrow on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.
I have very often expressed my my love for the Free Press, Barry Weiss's organization, thefp.com, because they do good independent journalism. They do reporting that you're not going to see in the Washington Post, the New York Times, and elsewhere. And I thought this was really, really interesting. And it's another example, and we chronicle them time and time again, of some of the media nonsense that goes on out there. And here, yet again, is another example. Olivia Rheingold wrote this with Tanya Lukyanova, and we know Olivia. She's been a guest on this show. We might try to get her on tomorrow. But this has to do with a photo that was in the New York Times of this 18-month-old baby in Gaza on the front page of the paper. Mohammed Zakaria Ayub al-Matouk, who was the symbol for this story that was about widespread hunger in Gaza, wasn't, you were led to believe that it was just because of the evil Israelis and U.S. This poor kid who's 18 months old is starving. The only reason is because of, the war against Hamas and U.S. bad, Israel bad. But here's the deal. And this has happened time and time again. And this is so amazing, this reporting. And this is where I give the Free Press a lot of credit. And some of you might have heard about this, but I'm guessing most of you have not heard about this particular story. This young boy was not simply suffering from malnutrition. He had pre-existing health issues affecting his brain and his muscle development, according to an updated version of the story. But that didn't make it into print. So they did that as more of an editor's note, and they always hide that, and they did it 4 days later. It also quietly deleted the mother's claim that her son was born a healthy child. There was still no mention of the boy's brother, who appears healthy in the background of another photo that appeared online. And this was not just a one-off. So here's what Olivia and her fellow reporters say. An investigation by the Free Press reveals that at least a dozen other viral images of starvation in Gaza also lacked important context. The subjects of these photos have significant health problems. Those appeared all over social media, in the reports of leading international aid organizations, some of the most prestigious news outlets, you want to take a guess at what they were, CNN, NPR, The New York Times, without disclosing the complicated medical histories that help explain their stark appearances. It's misleading. It's lying. It's journalistic malpractice. Now, the reporting in the Free Press admits there's hunger, okay? You have the World Health Organization reporting that there were 63 deaths from malnutrition last month alone, including 25 children. Okay, fair enough. If you want to go back to 2022, before there was a war, 50 Gazans under the age of 20 died from malnutrition, according to health experts there. So you have somebody in this story who is cited by the name of Yanni Spitzer, who's an economist at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, who's been tracking food prices in Gaza the past few months. And he says that hunger in Gaza is declining largely since Israel resumed aid deliveries in late May after the 80-day blockade. In mid-July, for basic necessities like flour, the prices skyrocketed, according to his review of the data from the Gaza Chamber of Commerce and the World Food Program. And the quote in this story is, "If a situation like that lasts more than a few days, a lot of people will go hungry, but not starve to death en masse. That's the beginning of a process which the media portrays as already at the catastrophic end stage. But it never happened." Now, he does say food prices are 15 times higher than peacetime, but they're nowhere near their high point earlier this summer. It's very different from the Ethiopian-like famine pictures that readers in the West were led to believe. We've all seen the commercials. But those photos have been used in reckless and irresponsible and journalistically malpractice ways to convince Americans that Israel, in fact, has induced famine and is committing war crimes in Gaza. So they did a survey at something called the Data for Progress Center. Nearly half of the voters surveyed, they said that they believe Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinian people. In the Free Press article, they went line by line, child by child, Mariam Dawas. This is in a UNICEF ad soliciting donations. This is a 9-year-old girl who sits on a hospital bed staring off into space. Her collarbone protrudes underneath the pink T-shirt that she has on. When she takes a deep breath, she darts her eyes around as if strained. And it says that she's been suffering from malnutrition for a year and a half. And there's a message that's flashing up on the screen. It says, all children under five in the Gaza Strip are at risk of acute malnutrition. But this young girl is not typical. In fact, her mother suspected that her daughter was suffering from a serious illness that local doctors were struggling to diagnose. And she spoke about her battle to get answers in a video that was uploaded to another account, an Instagram account that has 500,000 followers. And she says, I suspect that Mariam has had another problem besides malnutrition. I suspect my daughter has a condition that no one understands here in Gaza. So that's one of the cases. They have another one. The Guardian, which is a lefty publication overseas. July 29th, you woke up to an image of a bony spine of a toddler named Yusuf Matar as he was cradled by his mother. And the headline is Famine Underway in Gaza. UN-backed experts say. That's always the warning sign. Whenever you see experts, that's big warning sign. So the caption says, displaced Palestinian mother, Samar Matar holds her malnourished son, Yusuf, in Gaza City. Reuters used the same image. Displaced Palestinian mother. But the problem is he suffers from cerebral palsy. And that came out. Then they go on down. They have three other kids here who had different issues. It was all blamed on malnutrition. It was blamed on Israel and, of course, the U.S. But the problem is there's other issues in nearly every situation here. So the New York Times goes out there with their correction, right, which barely anyone reads. They do a community note, and they don't do it on their main New York Times page. They do it on something else. So nobody really knows the difference. And then if you don't look at the free press or you don't know about the free press and you don't know about what really is happening out here, you don't know about the journalistic malpractice.
What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station tomorrow on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.
It's taking... I have very often expressed my love for the free press, Barry Weiss's organization, thefp.com, because they do good independent journalism. They do reporting that you're not going to see in the Washington Post, the New York Times, and elsewhere. And I thought this was really, really interesting. And it's another example, and we chronicle them time and time again, of some of the media nonsense that goes on out there. And here, yet again, is another example. Olivia Rheingold wrote this with Tanya Lukyanova, and we know Olivia. She's been a guest on this show. We might try to get her on tomorrow. But this has to do with a photo that was in the New York Times of this 18-month-old baby in Gaza on the front page of the paper. Mohammed Zakaria Ayub Al-Matouk, who was the symbol for this story that was about widespread hunger in Gaza, wasn't, you were led to believe that it was just because of the evil Israelis and U.S. This poor kid who's 18 months old is starving. The only reason is because of, the war against Hamas and U.S. bad, Israel bad. But here's the deal. And this has happened time and time again. And this is so amazing, this reporting. And this is where I give the free press a lot of credit. And some of you might have heard about this, but I'm guessing most of you have not heard about this particular story. This young boy was not simply suffering from malnutrition. He had pre-existing health issues affecting his brain and his muscle development, according to an updated version of the story. But that didn't make it into print. So they did that as more of an editor's note, and they always hide that, and they did it 4 days later. It also quietly deleted the mother's claim that her son was born a healthy child. There was still no mention of the boy's brother, who appears healthy in the background of another photo that appeared online. And this was not just a one-off. So here's what Olivia and her fellow reporters say. An investigation by the Free Press reveals that at least a dozen other viral images of starvation in Gaza also lacked important context. The subjects of these photos have significant health problems. Those appeared all over social media, in the reports of leading international aid organizations, some of the most prestigious news outlets. You want to take a guess at what they were? CNN, NPR, The New York Times, without disclosing the complicated medical histories that help explain their stark appearances. It's misleading. It's lying. It's journalistic malpractice. Now, the reporting in the Free Press admits there's hunger. Okay? You have the World Health Organization reporting that there were 63 deaths from malnutrition last month alone, including 25 children. Okay, fair enough. If you want to go back to 2022, before there was a war, 50 Gazans under the age of 20 died from malnutrition, according to health experts there. So you have somebody in this story who is cited by the name of Yanni Spitzer, who's an economist at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, who's been tracking food prices in Gaza the past few months. And he says that hunger in Gaza is declining largely since Israel resumed aid deliveries in late May after the 80-day blockade. In mid-July, for basic necessities like flour, the prices skyrocketed, according to his review of the data from the Gaza Chamber of Commerce and the World Food Program. And the quote in this story is, "If a situation like that lasts more than a few days, a lot of people will go hungry, but not starve to death en masse. That's the beginning of a process which the media portrays as already at the catastrophic end stage. But it never happened." Now, he does say food prices are 15 times higher than peacetime, but they're nowhere near their high point earlier this summer. It's very different from the Ethiopian-like famine pictures that readers in the West were led to believe. We've all seen the commercials. But those photos have been used in reckless and irresponsible and journalistically malpractice ways to convince Americans that Israel, in fact, has induced famine and is committing war crimes in Gaza. So they did a survey at something called the Data for Progress Center. Nearly half of the voters surveyed, they said that they believe Israel is committing genocide against the Palestinian people. In the Free Press article, they went line by line, child by child, Mariam Dawas. This is in a UNICEF ad soliciting donations. This is a 9-year-old girl who sits on a hospital bed staring off into space. Her collarbone protrudes underneath the pink T-shirt that she has on. When she takes a deep breath, she darts her eyes around as if strained. And it says that she's been suffering from malnutrition for a year and a half. And there's a message that's flashing up on the screen. It says, "All children under 5 in the Gaza Strip are at risk of acute malnutrition." But this young girl is not typical. In fact, her mother suspected that her daughter was suffering from a serious illness that local doctors were struggling to diagnose. And she spoke about her battle to get answers in a video that was uploaded to another account, an Instagram account that has 500,000 followers. And she says, "I suspect that Mariam has had another problem besides malnutrition. I suspect my daughter has a condition that no one understands here in Gaza." So that's one of the cases. They have another one. The Guardian, which is a lefty publication overseas, July 29th, "You woke up to an image of a bony spine of a toddler named Yusuf Matar as he was cradled by his mother." And the headline is, "Famine underway in Gaza, UN-backed experts say." That's always the warning sign. Whenever you see experts, that's big warning sign. So the caption says, "Displaced Palestinian mother Samar Matar holds her malnourished son Yusuf in Gaza City." Reuters used the same image. Displaced Palestinian mother. But the problem is he suffers from cerebral palsy. And that came out. Then they go on down. They have 3 other kids here who had different issues. It was all blamed on malnutrition. It was blamed on Israel and, of course, the U.S. But the problem is there's other issues in nearly every situation here. So the New York Times goes out there with their correction, right, which barely anyone reads. They do a community note, and they don't do it on their main New York Times page. They do it on something else. So nobody really knows the difference. And then if you don't look at the Free Press or you don't know about the Free Press and you don't know about what really is happening out here, you don't know about the journalistic malpractice that's taking place.
Traffic from the 97.1 FM Talk Traffic Center.
Well, we've had a big issue on the roads this afternoon on northbound 270 past Doherty Ferry. And it was a vehicle, it's an accident, but the vehicle itself rolled over, one of them did. And now we've gone from 4 left lanes blocked to 2. So things are improving along there, but you're still jammed on northbound 270 back to 44. And that's making a dent. It's really causing a delay for those drivers eastbound 44 trying to ramp on to northbound 270, but it is getting better. Southbound is slow back through Olive. 141 pretty busy, and this is at at 44 this afternoon. Southbound 55 slowing at Bates. Westbound 40 is slow Hampton out through McCausland. Now we've got an accident reported eastbound 40 before Lindbergh. That's causing a jam back through 270. Slow moving traffic eastbound 5570 on the Illinois side, headed for the 64 split, and 64 eastbound is pretty slow, especially at 158. This report brought to you by Lakeside Renovation and Design. For over 25 years, they've been St. Louis's trusted choice for transforming homes inside and out. Windows, siding, kitchens, baths, outdoor spaces. They deliver quality craftsmanship backed by lifetime warranties. Visit lakesiderd.com to start your dream project today. I'm Sue Thomas with Traffic, 97.1 FM Talk, St. Louis Conservative.
Are you nearing retirement and don't know if you have enough money saved to retire? That is scary. Do you have a written retirement financial plan in place? Well, when it comes to retirement planning, the trusted team at Financial and Tax Architects are the best. They've helped people all over St. Louis retire with confidence. And that's what you want. You want to retire with confidence. Now, they offer a one-night, two-and-a-half-hour adult education class called Retirement Planning 101. They hold these at colleges over the St. Louis area and in Illinois. No cost, no obligation, just learning. And at this class, you learn how to avoid costly mistakes, how to maximize your income, how to reduce taxes in retirement. So call them today, 314-888-5101. Or visit FTA-RIA.com and take the first step toward a smarter retirement. 314-888-5101.
You've been listening to the very popular Wellness One for many years, Saturdays and Sundays on 97.1 FM Talk. We're happy to share that we've expanded the show to four times a week. Yes, four times every weekend. Saturday at 10 a.m., Saturday at 8 p.m., Sunday at 9 a.m., and Sunday at 2 p.m. It's the same great show designed to cut through the nonsense and provide you a common sense, science-based strategy for a healthy life. So join TJ and Aaron for Wellness One. Now, four times a week on 97.1 FM Talk.
Brotherhood of Rock. Welcome to the Grand Now, they Illusion. Celebrate 25 years.
Come for me to fly.
Styx.
Come sail away. Come sail.
Kevin Cronin. Former lead singer of REO Speedwagon. Special guest Don Felder, formerly of the Eagles. This Friday night, Hollywood Casino Amphitheater. Tickets on sale now at LiveNation.com. Styx, Kevin Cronin, Don Felder, Brotherhood of Rock.
When you're approaching retirement, there are a lot of questions to answer. Do you have enough money to fund your income for life? How should you claim Social Security? And what's your plan for health care and long-term care? Hi, I'm Eric Robert, Director of Investments with the ClearPath Wealth Management Group at Stifel and host of On the Money Saturday mornings at 11 on 97.1 FM Talk. Don't leave your retirement to chance. It's crucial to understand and address relevant risks before you retire. Our team can help you get organized, guide you through critical retirement decisions, and create an investment portfolio designed around your needs. To schedule your free retirement plan consultation, go to clearpathinvesting.com. That's clearpathinvesting.com. Or call us at 636-695-2650. That's clearpathinvesting.com or 636-695-2650. Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
It's time for a $98 AC tune-up.
And at 5:39, this portion of the show is sponsored by Jerry Kelly Heating and Air.
For details and a list of all station contest rules, visit www.971talk.com/rules.
Born in the Midwest, built on common sense. 97.1 FM Talk, St. Louis Conservative.
I feel like I am maybe not owed, that's not the right word, but maybe I've earned a honorary PhD in exposing DEI because of my conversations with John Seiler, who's with us tonight again, Director of Higher Education Policy and a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute. I feel like I've been here with you from the beginning, blowing all this stuff up, John, with a lot of successes, more and more lately. How are you this afternoon?
I'm doing great. Always great to be here.
I never got to this last week. It was on my list, but there was yet another piece, this one in Real Clear Investigations, from a guy by the name of Dr. Kendall Conger, who was fired by Duke University because he started blowing up some of this DEI stuff years ago. And he was very happy that without public notice, they scrubbed their website of the commitment to DEI that they trumpeted in 2021 when they said racism is a public health crisis and equity is its cure. Now, the new statement of values is a little different, and it says leading with the heart rooted in humanity. And I guess the original one there was Duke Health stands against racism, bias, and hate. And his story is another one, John, that is like so many of these people in higher education, the ones that had the guts to say, this is ridiculous that we're, you know, putting so much focus on the color of someone's skin or their belief in Marxism outside of their qualifications to be a doctor.
Yeah, and you know, his story is not an isolated incident, and it's really interesting now to see that universities can kind of see which way the wind is blowing, and that is exposing that while there have been a lot of true believers out there, there are also a lot of university administrators and professors who just went along and who were actually a part of, you know, for lack of a better term, the cancellation mob, who are now, you know, striking a very different tone. And that's an interesting thing to see unfold, even though there's still a lot of craziness out there.
Yeah, that you continue to expose. So on the good news front, the good news is at the end of July, the DOJ sends a letter to all the federal grant recipients reaffirming the principle of civil rights that discrimination is unlawful, right? No matter who you're discriminating against, it's unlawful. So there's a lot of people, I think, a lot of lawyers at these big universities that have been put on notice. We've seen university after university peel back on the DEI front. But then you still find places out there like, what is this, the University of Texas in Austin, or it's a different university where they're still, and you're finding documents and receipts that show how much emphasis they place on the hiring, you know, focus of diversity, equity, and inclusion versus requirements or experience or expertise or anything along those lines.
Yeah, so the DOJ released a very well-reasoned, very legally solid document laying out what it actually means to say that discrimination in hiring is illegal. And the document lays out a lot of practices that we've talked about before. It talks about not just giving racial preferences, but also using proxies. So if you use the proxy of lived experience and say, we're not hiring on the basis of race, we're hiring on the basis of your underrepresented lived experience, or things like that, that too is illegal. And it goes through a list of different practices, you know, diverse slate policies, the use of diversity statements, if they're being used as a proxy. And you look through it, the dozen or so practices, and I could say that for each one that it lists, universities have constantly engaged in these practices for years. And so last week I released just a set of documents showing, yeah, for if you just go down the list, I can point to a document from UT Austin, I can point to a document from the University of Illinois, I can point to documents from Cornell, from University of Michigan, just go down the list, and it's all there in writing. As one university professor told me a long time ago when I started doing this reporting, every day the universities wake up and break the law. And that's why this DOJ memo is so significant, because the DOJ memo comes with teeth. This is the federal government's law enforcement arm essentially saying that if you want to continue to have federal funding, you have to follow these basic rules.
So, for example, at the UT Austin situation, there was one thing that you acquired that showed that in a search for a professor of environmental biotechnology, one quarter of that candidate's overall score is supposed to come from the DEI category, 25%.
Yeah, that's correct. So this was a search back in 2022 The Texas legislature has stepped in since then, and so we would hope that in a 2025 search this wouldn't happen. But you know, 2022 wasn't that long ago, and UT Austin is a university in a red state that actually has cared a long time about these issues. And if you just peel back the surface a little bit, what do you see? You see that they were engaged in not just marginally, but massively tipping the scale in favor of environmental biotechnology experts' ability to contribute to DEI. I mean, there are so many reasons that this would be seemingly just absurd to any dispassionate, unbiased observer, because it has nothing to do with what is no doubt a very technical field at a top American public university. So that on its own is sort of ridiculous. But moreover, I think it's really important to underscore that this category for a long time has just been used as a substitute for race. And that's not allowed. That's never been allowed, but now it's been made crystal clear. And if UT Austin was doing it, you can bet that universities around the country have constantly engaged in this kind of practice. And this is a real moment of reckoning. And I can tell you, I know that universities are being incredibly cautious now, because they know that if they engage in this kind of practice, it will be found out and they will get in a lot of trouble.
Yeah, I think the lawyers are involved now. Now, you mentioned Illinois in Champaign, not too far from where we are right now. You end up getting an email exchange where there's a professor on a search committee that asks an HR officer to, quote, unmask the job candidate's demographic information so he could identify people, and the quote is, who are or might be eligible for a special fellowship. Right now, that's not legal in and of itself, right? And the HR officer mm-hmm. even said that. I can't do that, right?
Right. And they have a fellowship that requires you to know what demographic information candidates have. Already that suggests that this is a demographic-based fellowship, and that is concerning. What's interesting is that the email exchange continues, and they say, the HR officer says, we cannot tell you the demographic information of the job candidates. The professor says, well, how am I supposed to know who of these job candidates applying for a regular job is eligible for this special side deal fellowship that we have? And a diversity officer chimes in and he says, well, just look at the diversity statement. That should have the information. This is something that people have always assumed diversity statements do. It's just a way to tick the box when the box isn't there, a way to tick the box when you're not actually allowed to officially say, what your demographic information is, which in certain states, they don't collect that information. University of Illinois obviously didn't per their HR policy. So a lot of people have suspected this for a long time. But what's really interesting is there it is, right in the written word, in public documents that were available through public records requests. These things are out there. Even in my capacity, just as an investigative journalist, I find it all the time. So just imagine what's going to happen when the federal government gets involved and when they get these documents.
Yeah, that could be fascinating.
These investigations are going to be explosive if they ever get to the point of, the equivalent of legal discovery.
John Seiler, who's the director of higher education policy and a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, and just really a hero on this DEI stuff and exposing it. John, you know how much of a fan I am. Thank you so much for continuing to do this work. And yes, this could get very interesting in the future with the DOJ involved. But I hope you're having a good time and a good week, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you.
All right, take care, John. Well, I guess it's a good thing for Andrew Bailey, but I am selfishly not happy with this. We alluded to this earlier on the show, and just about 90 seconds ago, our Attorney General Andrew Bailey, soon to be our former Attorney General, said, I'm proud to announce that I've accepted the role of co-deputy director of the FBI. I extend my thanks to POTUS and AG Pam Bondi for the opportunity to serve in the mission to make America safe again. I will protect America and uphold the Constitution. I've gotten rather close with Andrew Bailey, and I'm happy for him as far as, this being the next step in his career. But I thought he was doing such a great job here in Missouri, and I don't know who the top of the list might be here for the next AG, but we got another AG coming because Andrew Bailey is going to Washington.
Standby. Playback ready.
Now, the audio cut of the day.
All right, I'll make it a quick one here because all of the leaders of the Western nations and Zelensky met with Trump today in Washington. The meeting lasted maybe 3 hours. Not much has been said since, but here's what the president said earlier today.
It's been almost 4 years now that millions of people killed, but a lot of people last week, for whatever reason, a big number, a lot of soldiers, both on both sides. And I know the president, I know myself, and I believe Vladimir Putin wants to see it ended.
We'll have more on this tomorrow. We'll have more on Andrew Bailey, of course, at 3 o'clock tomorrow. Have a great night.
Get more at 971talk.com.
What's on your mind right now? The song you can't get out of your head? That breaking story? Or that conversation you just have to be a part of?
That's the brand new song from...
This is a breaking news report.
He shoots! He scores!
That's radio. Happening now. Connecting you to what matters most exactly when it's happening. From the airwaves to every device you stream on, radio is everywhere you are. It's local, live, and it's for you. Tag your favorite radio station tomorrow on social media and use hashtag National Radio Day to celebrate. That's hashtag National Radio Day.